tonight on Arena. We'll review the latest series of Wednesday, filmed in Ireland, and we'll have albums from the Black Keys and For Those I Love. You can contact us tonight on 51551. Emails are arena@rte.ie, and we are on X at RTE Arena. We'll start with TV tonight. Wednesday season 2 has finally landed on Netflix. This time, Wednesday Adams, played by Jenna Ortega, is back at Nevermore Academy and has mastered her psychic visions. She's using her secret power to face down her enemies. Catherine Zeta-Jones reprises her role as Morticia, and Joanna Lumley plays Grandmama. It's also time for season 2 of Apple TV's hit comedy Platonic, with Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne as best friends Will and Sylvia. Will has asked his girlfriend to marry him and charged Sylvia with the wedding planning, but Will is already having difficulty leaving his bachelor ways behind. Sylvia is struggling with family and work. And In Flight is a Channel 4 crime thriller starring Catherine Kelly as Jo Conran, a flight attendant whose life is upended when her son is jailed in Bulgaria for a murder he insists he didn't commit. Blackmailed and smuggling drugs to save her son, Jo navigates a dangerous underworld as she travels between Bangkok, Bulgaria, Istanbul and London. And joining me to see if any of them are worth your valuable binge-watching time this weekend, Jen Gannon and Declan Burke. We're going to start with Wednesday on Netflix. Jenna Ortega back as the deadpan gothic teenager Wednesday Adams. Jen, bring us up to speed. What's happening in Wednesday's life at the beginning of this season?
Yeah, well, Wednesday was just this massive success, we have to say, first of all, because I don't even think Netflix saw it coming, how unbelievably successful it became. It was like 341.2 million hours viewing, which bet Stranger Things season 4, and it's in the Netflix Hall of Fame now. So there was high expectations about what they wanted to happen in season 2, where they wanted her to go as a character. And when you look at somebody like Tim Burton, who is the Ichabod Crane of the multiplex, you see that I think he thinks he's found his Gen Z Winona Ryder in Jenna Ortega, and seems to have christened her that by having her in the Beetlejuice reboot with Winona, and now with Wednesday full steam ahead. And it became a touchstone for a lot of preteens and teenagers. There was a Buffy-like quality to it where she was almost like a superhero. She wasn't like the Christina Ricci character that I grew up in. I think every millennial loves those Barry Sonfield films. They're ridiculous. They're amazing. And we thought we had our Wednesday, but I think Jenna Ortega brings something different to this role. And very memeable. We had this breakout viral moment where she was doing the dance to the Cramps Goo Goo Muck, which introduced a whole legion of teenagers and younger to the Cramps, which I think is only a good thing. So the expectations are out of control for this. And I think you have the setup of Nevermore, which is Harry Potter for the wayward, for the outcasts. Mm-hmm. And she, in a turn of events in season 1, Wednesday ended up saving the school and saving the students, which is not very cool for a goth to be popular.
She's not happy with
this
at all.
She's not happy with dealing with her popularity, her newfound fame. So when we're back in Nevermore, she's now joined by her brother Pugsy, who is there to get control of his own powers as well. So I think it's he's like telekinesis, I think, is his.
He sets fire to a lot of things.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. So it's more, I think the criticism of the first season was that we want the Addams family. It's not just about Wednesday. We want to see Morticia, we want to see Gomez, and I want to see Catherine Zeta-Jones. I want to see more of her. I love her. And she vamps it up as Morticia this time around, more so getting the family involved in looking after this new camp for Nevermore, and she's going to be chaperoning these trips. And that brings her into contact with the new principal, Barry Dort, who's played by Steve Buscemi. And he's this descendant of Edgar Allan Poe, and he has the hair to prove it. And I loved him as an addition to the cast, because Steve Buscemi is the perfect choice for someone within this world. He's googly-eyed, he has the spindly limbs, he's a good Tim Burton player. We've seen him in Big Fish, and he gets the campy comedy of it all. But just to say, this is a massive expansion on season 1. If you thought season 1 was, you know, mind-boggling with the amount of characters we have, season 2 packs them in big style.
We should mention, maybe even just briefly, at the very beginning of this, there is a tiny, wonderful little story where she has a summer holiday and goes off and finds a serial killer who no one has seen for decades and manages to then bring him in. At one point, one of the characters asks her what she did for her summer and she says, I scalped a serial killer.
Isn't that every teen's dream for their summer holiday?
And it's Haley Joel Osment.
It is. And he's great with another great wig. Yeah. So many good wigs in this season. So he's known as the Kansas City Scalper and she does, that's what how she spends her summer, her time off.
Maybe before we take a clip from this, Declan, we do see a lot more of the family here, particularly Pugsley arrives at the school now and her parents become more involved. It is slightly more old school Adams family in terms of its feel, isn't it?
It is in terms of they've widened out the family, as Jen says. My memory now, I didn't see the first the series, my memory of the original Adams family, and I go way back. So they use the gothic tropes, they use the characters for the purpose of humour. And there is humour here, there's no doubt about that, but it's very, very, very dark. The emphasis is very much on the gothic aspect rather than the comic aspect. So Pugsley, he's not a very comic character. I think Gomez and Morticia, there's a great comic chemistry between them. Lovely to see Catherine Zeta-Jones back front and centre again, and Louis Guzman as Gomez, sorry. So, yeah, it's nice to see the wider family and, of course, the Thing.
We shouldn't leave Thing out. Thing hasn't gotten a mention yet.
He's absolutely vital to virtually all the proceedings. So, yeah, no, it's really nice to see it broadened out that way. But just to sound a note of warning, as Jen says, once they broaden it out, the number of plot strands and subplots that they absolutely crowbar into the first two episodes is very confusing, really.
Okay, let's take a clip from very close to the beginning. After attacking some bullies in her old school, Wednesday, played by Jenna Ortega, is being driven to Nevermore Academy by her parents, who are Catherine Zeta-Jones playing Morticia and Louise Guzman playing Gomez.
Darling, how long do you intend on giving us the cold shoulder?
Lurch, please remind my parents that I'm no longer speaking to them.
I promise you, my little viper, you will love Nevermore. Won't she, Tish?
Of course you will. It's the perfect school for her.
Why? Because it was the perfect school for you? I have no interest in following in your footsteps, becoming captain of the fencing team, queen of the dark prom, president of the Seance Society.
I merely meant that finally you will be among peers who understand you. Maybe you'll even make some friends.
Nevermore is like no other boarding school. It's a magical place. It's where I met your mother. And we fell in love.
You guys are making me nauseous. Not in a good way.
Darling, we aren't the ones who got you expelled. That boy's family was going to file attempted murder charges. How would that have looked on your record?
Terrible. Everyone would know I failed to get the job done.
And that's Wednesday when she originally arrives in Nevermore. Jen, there are familiar faces joining the cast. Billy Piper turns up very close to the beginning. Thandiwe Newton and Steve Buscemi. I think he deserves a little greater spotlight because he's an absolute ray of joy in this, really, both in terms of his character and as always when you see Steve Buscemi turn up in anything.
You want him to stay there and he just embodies, as I said, that Tim Burton. He gets what it is to be a Tim Burton player. We've seen him do that in Big Fish, but I think here he really gets the campy comedy that underlies, it's underlying within this show. And you also have Christopher Lloyd, who was in the Sonnenfeld Adams family before, and he's returning in a different role, obviously, in this as Professor Orloff. So he's Nevermore's longest serving teacher. So it's a nice throwback in a way to the films themselves. But like we were saying, and sorry, we haven't mentioned Joanna Lumley properly. She's having really good fun here, I have to say. And it feels as the grandmama Hester Frump, which is a great name. And she's having a grand old time. And Fred Armisen is back as Uncle Fester, who was played by Christopher Lloyd in the Sonnenfeld films. But with all these characters, like we were saying, there's not enough time. There's too much to do. There's too much for Wednesday to be getting on with. And therein lies the problem. You have all the talent, but none of the time to actually expand on the talent and give them proper characterisation.
Sure. Declan, I mentioned that Ireland is the filming location for this, and I think for the upcoming season 3 as well. Talk to us a little about that. Tim Burton directs a couple of the first 4 episodes, so that kind of has his stamp on it as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that you know that it's filmed in Ireland because of Tim Burton's style.
Certainly not episode one. I saw episode one and it could have been anywhere.
It could have been anywhere, yeah. Absolutely. There's one kind of high vertical shot that I think is a nod to The Shining that, you know, you're kind of going, okay, that could be somewhere in Wicklow and so forth. But yeah, his style, we're talking about, you know, the excessively grotesque characters. We're talking about, you know, and Wednesday is brilliant at exploring the darker psyches of or aspects of the human psyche. And there's also a lovely bit of, it's not long enough, lovely bit of animation that, you know, kind of is real classic.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Tim Burton.
It's very old school Frankenweenie.
Absolutely, kind of, yeah. I hoped that was going to be a repeating. Possibly it will throughout the series. But yeah, once you have that Tim Burton stamp in the first episode, he doesn't direct the second. Are we looking at the same quality of style in terms of the direction? I didn't think so.
Okay. Jenna Ortega is obviously the big shining star of the centre of this programme. Mm. It would be probably a different series without her, maybe not as watchable?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's this way of this unblinking contempt that she has for her classmates, which I find really enjoyable. And I know why that she is breathing new life into this character for those legions of fans. But I do find it's not a fault of Ortega, but you feel that there's this marketing mood boarding going on about demographics, trying to appease certain demographics, beefing up the character in a certain supernatural way is almost a bid to that kind of Marvel universe way of doing things. And those who enjoyed the black comedy of the Sonnenfelds, I don't know if, I think the series is a bit too whimsical, but she does find new ways to make deadpan delivery entertaining and droll, which I'll give her that for sure. And I loved the line, "I don't evolve, I cocoon." A great line.
And I've only seen the first episode so far, and I watched episode one of season one and kind of fell away from it. I thought maybe this isn't for me. I really enjoyed the first episode of this. I laughed, I chuckled, I giggled. It was great fun. Stars from both of you then.
So I think I agree with Jen. Jenna Ortega is terrific, very strong in a role that feels a bit one-dimensional to me. 3 stars for me.
Okay.
Yeah, I found myself just checking out at a bit of the lackluster teen love triangle storyline, and there's a lot of overblown silliness going on with the subplots, but I get why its audience are invested in it, and I hope that will lead them to discover doomy classics like Heathers and The Craft. Mm. So I'm all involved for that, so 3.
Okay, fair enough. That is season 2 of Wednesday, which is now out on Netflix. Just 3 months ago, Seth Rogen released his new series, The Studio. It's just gotten a record 23 Emmy nominations, and now he's back with a new season of Apple TV's Platonic. Declan, set this one up for us. Where are we?
So in the first season of Platonic, Will, who's played by Seth Rogen, and Sylvia, who's played by Rose Byrne, they used to be friends way back in college. Life has got in the way. Will has got married. Rose has got married and so forth. So they haven't seen each other for about a decade and a half. Will gets divorced and Rose hears about this. She tentatively reaches out and they tenuously start their friendship once more. And the kind of overarching theme of the first series is, can a man and woman really be friends without there being some kind of sexual attraction? It's that cold When Harry Met Sally kind of thing again. So the second series then starts with Will has met the woman of his dreams, Jenna, who's played by Rachel Rosenbloom. She's also his boss, which doesn't sound like a terrific idea to me. Sylvia, who is a lawyer by trade but has been a homemaker for the past 15 years or so, she has got back into the workplace as a party planner and she's organising Will's wedding, which she's brilliant as a party planner. Will is still a bit of a man-child. He has yet to either cocoon or evolve. therein kind of lies the conflict between the two characters.
Okay, let's take a clip from season 2 of Platonic.
Hey. You're leaving already?
Yeah, I gotta get to the club. Lot to do before tomorrow.
Yeah.
You excited?
Yes, very excited. Super excited.
Great.
Yep, yeah, super, super psyched.
What's wrong? You okay?
I got something I need to tell you, okay?
Oh my God, is she pregnant? Is Jenna pregnant?
No, fuck no. The opposite, actually, sort of, in some ways. I have a crush on somebody.
What?
I have a crush on somebody.
What the hell are you trying to tell me? Are you having an
affair? No, I'm just, it's an innocent crush. That's all I'm telling you. I have an innocent crush on you. Have you never had a crush on somebody before?
Yeah, when I was a child.
No, there you go. You know what it's like. That's what I got. I got one of those, okay?
What do you mean? Is this going to blow everything up?
No, it's just an innocent, it's a small little fuck. Well, I can't keep these feelings locked inside me.
Yes, you can. That's marriage. Just lock it up. Shut it down. Just bury it.
I told you. Too late.
What's wrong with you? Forget it.
Look, you know what? I shouldn't have said anything because it was a joke.
What?
I never said anything. I never brought this up. This never happened.
Still here?
Hey,
oh my God.
Sweetie.
Hi.
What's up?
Oh my God.
Good to see you. Yeah, yes. So, yeah.
It's so great to see you. And I'll see you later. See you tomorrow. Bye.
And that is Will speaking to Sylvia the day before his engagement party with Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne. And that's Rachel Rosenbloom at the end as his fiancée, Jenna. Will's new fiancée, Jenna, who is also his boss. Again, let's leave that to one side for a moment. Adding her into the mix of the nature of his relationship with Sylvia and his friendship with her, that's an interesting dynamic. It's a strange one.
It is, because it taps into how threatening this new person, Jenna, finds their close friendship of Sylvia. I mean, that's the problem with Sylvia and Will. And it brings up also that tricky but entirely familiar situation for a lot of people when Sylvia tries to connect with Jenna herself, just the two of them. She discovers that Jenna might not be the nicest of people. And what does she do? Does she tell Will? Does she not? How does she voice those concerns? And what do you do as a friend? And there are the tensions. That's where the tension takes place of those early episodes. And it is about, with Jenna coming in as the new person, does she have to worry about the strength of their relationship? But also, as the second season unfolds, it's more, are these two people good for each other as friends? That comes into play as well. Or are they reckless? Are they reckless in each other's company and, you know, destructive?
Well, the short answer to that is yes, obviously. Yeah. I've already seen that
happen.
That's
what friends should be.
Declan, it's the interesting thing about this series and what I've seen of it so far is that you've got Seth Rogen and you've got Rose Byrne, and they've got great on-screen chemistry. But normally when you say the phrase on-screen chemistry, that means something, and it means sexual chemistry. Whereas here, it's a different kind of chemistry, and this show is not playing the will-they-won't-they game with us, because it's obviously a won't they, and that's what makes this interesting.
I completely agree, Rick, because I watched the first couple of episodes of season two, went back and watched the whole of season one precisely for that reason, because they didn't take the easy option. And the easy option, as you say, is will they, won't they, and there's a frisson there and so forth. They're absolutely adamant from the start that this is not going to happen. And in the way that Jenna feels jealousy about the nature of the relationship, Charlie, who is played by Luke McFarlane and is Sylvia's husband, we see his insecurities and jealousies and so forth coming into play as well. So to develop that chemistry without that kind of fallback or that safety net of just going, oh, you know, will I give her a peck on the cheek and so forth, it's a real testament to the two characters. I'd love to know how well or otherwise these characters get on off screen, because when they're on screen, they just feel like old friends. Mm. They're constantly bickering, and yet they constantly have one another's backs. They're giving one another tough love, but they're also kind of pushing each other down to take decisions that maybe they shouldn't take and then justify. It's all the kind of things you would want a good friend to be. They just happen to be of two different genders.
For those people who've seen series one, Jen, how do you compare this to it? And do you think series three is on the way?
Oh, guys, I don't know what you're seeing here. I think that Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen give enjoyable performances, even though I find too much exposure to Seth Rogen gives me a full-on headache. The man is Fozzie Bear most of the time.
Is it just his outfits in this?
It's just the way he acts. Everything has to descend into barking, shouting and pushing each other. And there's a lot of that slapstick that every kind of joke scenario with the two of them descends into. I don't find them believable as best mates. We're kidding ourselves here. They would never have survived the post-college. I don't believe that. This is not the lived-in chumminess of something like Spaced that you saw with Daisy Steiner and Tim Beasley. They don't feel like they would have spent hours in each other's company goofing around and talking crap. Like, there's a forced element to this endeavour that makes it difficult viewing for me. I just think I don't see Sylvia ever giving Will the time of day in reality. And I think Rose Byrne is a great performer. I think she's very versatile and she does really well here, but, and I would have waved all of that away if the jokes were there, but I also think that it doesn't raise much of more than a grin for me.
I have two thoughts on that. Spaced is a very high bar. Secondly, that's a good question as well. Like, I did find this funny. I laughed like a drain on more than one occasion, and I'm a tough audience to play to. So for both of you, is it funny?
I think it's very funny. I didn't find it on a laugh out loud every 5 minutes or every 2 minutes. What I love is the kind of comedy that works when two characters are kind of fully intertwined in one another and are constantly tripping up one another despite one another's best efforts. I think there's a development from season one in that the Seth Rogen character becomes that bit more vulnerable and open, and it's unusual for Seth Rogen to play that kind of character. You mentioned the studio, he's playing the old Seth Rogen thing, and it is that Fozzie Bear quality, as Jen suggests. I think there's a new maturity to him in this second season. Having said that, I agree with Jen. Rose Byrne is the best thing about it. She's comic brilliance.
I think he's playing Matt Remick from The Studio in this as well. I think there's very little difference. Look, from both of you stars, please.
I think it's terrific, smart, funny, two terrifically enjoyable leading characters. Excuse me, 4 stars.
Okay. I don't think comedy has to be world changing, but I think even as an easy Friday night watch, I found it to lack the smarts that I want from a comedy. So 2.
Ooh. Harsh. We are back in a moment with the last of our TV series this week. It's Channel 4's new one, In Flight. You're listening to Arena Finally tonight, Channel 4's new series, In Flight. It is a gritty thriller starring ex-Coronation Street actress Catherine Kelly as a flight attendant who gets a late-night call from her estranged son. He's in a Bulgarian prison. Jen, hopefully the two showrunners involved in this, Mike Walden and Adam Randall, they're immediately a guarantee of some sort of quality?
They know high octane. So Adam Randall, he directed the nail-shredding season 4 of Slow Horses. And I think I've just only recovered from Mike Walden's Marcella, which starred Anna Friel as the most unhinged detective in the most impossible situations. So, you know, with their names on the door, you're expecting something, you know what you're in for with In Flight. So you have Catherine Kelly, and she is one of those ex-Corrie actresses that should have had the career that those powerhouses like Sarah Lancashire and Saran Jones had when they split from the Cobbles. And Kelly, when Kelly was Becky in Coronation Street, she had this brilliant range, and she gave that character a greatness that it probably didn't even deserve. And it felt like she was on her way too, but she's had a career that's had fits and starts, and the material hasn't always matched her talent. I think she was great in the Yorkshire Ripper drama The Long Shadow that was out recently. I think she was really good in that. But I'm glad to see her back in this role. We have her playing this rough around the edges single mom called Jo, and Jo is in a bit of a pickle, to put that mildly. So she gets that phone call from her teen son. He's managed to get arrested in Bulgaria for murdering a young lad in a bar brawl. And she has been estranged from her son, Sonny, played by Harry Cadby, for a while, and he chose to live with his feckless father and is spiraling into chaos, as we can see.
I like very much that happens very, very quickly. The story just rattles through and gets to a point where we've reached something that we want to talk to. Cormac, Declan, is a gangland operative. We know relatively little about him at the beginning, but he exploits Joe's situation and then kind of makes her an offer that she has no choice but to accept.
Yeah, it's a kind of terrifying scene, I'll be perfectly honest, because Jo's already in a difficult situation and she comes home, there's two burly chaps waiting for her in the dark house, and he shows her footage on his mobile phone live from the Bulgarian prison in which her son is. She can see her son playing cards and a guy standing behind him with a shiv. And they're saying to her, you know, just say the word, say the wrong word, and we can just, you know, do the needful. And it's incredibly real. And a lot of it is to do with Catherine Kelly's performance. But then they outline the plan. It's, you know, because she's a flight attendant, because flight attendants, you know, don't get their, you know, their baggage checked and so forth, he wants her to ship heroin home from Istanbul, and he makes it sound like as if it's going to be a once-off deal. We suspect otherwise.
As we should. We'll take a clip from In Flight. This is Jo Conran visiting her son, Sonny, in a Bulgarian jail. Catherine Kelly and Harry Cadby.
You've grown your hair. I didn't recognise you. For a second, I was relieved. I thought this whole thing's a mistake.
This is a mistake. I didn't do it.
Yeah, I know. Of course you didn't. Why don't you tell me you're in Sofia? If I'd have known, I just thought you were at your dad's.
Oh, well, you were right about him. I was just embarrassed to come home.
So you went travelling?
Mum, look, those lads in the fight, right? I didn't even know them. And that Bulgarian kid they're speaking about, Christian Georgiev. Why would I? Is it true? What they're saying? Is he dead?
Jen, Catherine Kelly's performance in this, I really liked it. I think she's fantastic. Do you think this is going to be the big breakout role?
I hope so, because there's a complexity here within the son mother-son relationship that I won't go into, but there is something much deeper there, and she's very good at going into that dark night of the soul, thinking about her son and their relationship and interrogating her role as a mother, which I think it can really get her teeth into, and then also just being kind of charmed by this way of life, this underworld way of life. You see that unfold too. So she's very good at displaying that kind of distress and the moral dilemma, but also maybe the enjoyment factor of this too, which is interesting.
And Declan, I hadn't thought about this until you mentioned it earlier on, but it's not on a streamer, it's on Channel 4. And you thought the ad breaks actually enhanced your viewing experience, and actually thinking back to me watching, I think you're right about this.
It's terrific writing. I mean, they're leaning in. Nobody wants to watch the breaks, Rick. We know that, but the writers lean into it. I mean, it's chock-a-block with these cliffhangers and so forth, but they're very well done. They don't feel contrived. They don't feel as if they're kind of getting in the way of your viewing. And also, as the cliffhangers keep going, the cast gets bigger and bigger as more and more people get embroiled in Joe's situation. Terrific stuff.
Okay, stars from both of you?
I really enjoyed this. It's just the right side of fantastical that it feels believable enough, and it's flashy and gripping enough to keep audiences on their toes, and you want more. It's very Moorish. After you watch one episode, you're like, fire up the next one. Yeah. So I'll give it 3.5.
Okay.
Yeah, strip back, tense, if you like a good thriller. Absolutely, this is for you. Catherine Kelly is terrific. 4 stars from me.
Okay, Wednesday season 2 is streaming on Netflix. Platonic season 2 is available on Apple TV. And In Flight starts on Channel 4 next Tuesday, August the 12th. Jen Gannon and Declan Burke, thanks for joining me tonight on Arena. Time to look at new albums this week. It's Friday night's Arena. The second For Those I Love album, Carving the Stone, looks at the complexities of Dublin, at the things that make you want to leave it and the reasons why you can't. We'll be asking whether the Black Keys are any good at being the Black Keys? No Rain, No Flowers is their 13th album. It comes after a cancelled tour in 2024, and the 7th studio album by American musician MGK, formerly known as Machine Gun Kelly, is Lost Americana. And in an unusual move, in an increasingly baffling world, it has an album trailer narrated by Bob Dylan. But is it any good? Joining us this evening, Kian Sullivan and Louise Bruton. David Balfe, he's been one of those most exciting artists on the Irish music scene for a while. His Choice Music Prize-winning debut album, For Those I Love, it was met with critical acclaim, and rightly so. He is furious about contemporary Ireland in this new second album, Carving the Stone. Louise, maybe just remind people what his debut album was about.
So David Balfe goes by For Those I Love, and he comes from more of a punk kind of background than what the music you will hear sounds like. He delivers a lot of poetry, spoken word songs over very thudding electric beats. And his self-titled album that was released in 2021 eulogises his friend Paul Kern, who took his own life. And Paul would have been very involved in the local their area of Coolock where they grew up, working a lot with disadvantaged youths and bringing a lot of the struggles and obstacles that they were facing to the fore. And by honouring Paul's life in his music, Balfe then helped bring those topics to the conversation, to the mainstream conversation. The fact that it won Choice Music Prize of the Year proved that the topics of kind of male toxicity, male fragility, mental health, disadvantaged areas, continually to be disadvantaged. He brought a light to these topics so brilliantly, and he continues to do that on this album, where he focuses on Dublin in general. And if you've grown up here, if you spend most of your adult life here, there's so many things that you love about it, but he feels like he's suffocating in the city. And a big question he keeps asking is, should I stay or should I go?
Yeah. Cian, suicide also features on this album. How does he deal with it?
Yeah, and I just want to say, in the first album, I really, really enjoyed it. I felt really emotionally connected, because it actually came after me losing my sister to suicide. So I felt really emotionally swept up in it. So I had high expectations coming into this one. He is also, you know, dealing with grief as well on this with his friend, it's like at the track, the Ox, you know, who'd passed away. But there's also, you know, just a grief of, I guess, a life he thought he was going to have that he doesn't have, based on, you know, the forces at play within society right now. Like, I think he does a really great job at the social commentary in the track Mirror, where he kind of juxtaposes a real life experience of a knife crime with, you know, a figurative knife being held to his throat by society, who has deprived him from a house, who's prevented him from moving on further. So, yeah, I think, you know, he speaks incredibly well and summarizes the complexity of late stage capitalism in these gorgeous vignettes.
Yeah, let's play something from this. I'm going to play No Quiet, but maybe just tee it up for us. Sorry, Cian, if you can explain what this is about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's... Yeah, so No Quiet, actually, this is, I think, one of his best. He conjures this really quotidian tragedy of this family where the father has passed away from suicide, and you slowly follow the family's decline. You know, the brother and sister begin to fracture. There's addiction. There's, you know, someone turning in themselves. The mum turns in on herself, and you just sort of watch this tragedy unfold over 3 minutes.
Okay, let's have a listen. Her mother held her hand as she sang over. And that is For Those I Love. The new album is Carving the Stone, and that's called No Quiet. Louise, he is angry about how hard it is to live in Dublin in 2025. My favourite track on the album is probably Of the Sorrows. Talk to us about that. It's a nod to Deirdre of the Sorrows?
Deirdre of the Sorrows, yeah. So there is this running theme that goes through quite a lot of the songs. It's where love and hate, guilt and loyalty are constantly at odds of each other. And Cian kind of touched upon the song Mirror, where he speaks about having pride from where he's from. But when you compare that up against the rise of violent nationalism, what is pride? And that also comes into Of the Sorrows, where he kind of throws back to the price of a night is now the price of a pint. And he's 35 years old. So, you know, he's an adult now. He's a father. He sees this changing Dublin, and he just can't come to grips with what that means. And his poetic leanings, they really just allow him to express how much of a deep empath that he is. And it's something that we don't get to see a lot in, or hear a lot in music. But the fact that he is speaking this, he really just lets us in. He lets us into his world, into his orbit. And frustratingly, he sees the problems, but he also sees the cause. And the frustration that he has, the anger that he's feeling and that he puts into words, is that the people who can actually afford to fix these problems are the ones who are shifting the cost onto those who don't. And that is the relenting theme of this album. It's not a nice listen by any means, but it's a very truthful listen to the world that we are living in.
Yeah, very much so. Let's take a little bit of the Sorrows. And that's Of the Sorrows. Cian, the production on this is a different sound to the first album. I mean, I was listening at some stages. There are songs that sound like they belong in a kind of big room dance setting. Some of them are drum and bassy. There are times almost where you're listening to him, and his delivery is a bit like Maxi Jazz on a Faithless track.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, while I think it still feels in keeping with the art of For Those I Love, it's definitely darker, it's gruffer. I think Balfe sounds more weather beaten. You heard the Irish fiddles in that. There's still kind of computery bleep loops. But I think what this album kind of misses is levity. I think, you know, while obviously the first album is heartbreaking, it's about suicide, it's kind of grounded in the joy of the time we still spent together. And I think what this lacks, and this comes through in the music, is there's kind of no happy ending to this because we're all still in it. And I think that is something that I think we could have done with at the end.
Okay, can I get stars from both of you?
Yeah, look, I really want him to succeed, and I really want to hear what he does next. This one just maybe didn't hit home emotionally the way the first one did. 3.5 stars. Okay.
It's 5 from me, which is, I think he really just captures the hypocrisy and the institutional wrongs that we're all seeing day to day.
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to give stars, but I am going to give it a 5 as well. It's the only one that I'm going to give for the night. Before we move on from For Those I Love and the themes of suicide, for anybody affected by those themes, you can visit rte.ie/helplines. Now, the Black Keys are still really good at being the Black Keys, said Rolling Stone magazine, and the reliable rock duo ground themselves with a smooth, solid LP after a career hiccup. Is Rolling Stone magazine right? Louise, No Rain, No Flowers from the Black Keys, it's album number 13, comes after the cancelled tour in 2024. Is the idea behind the album to turn their struggles into art, and does it work?
I think that was their intention. So the background of this is they had this huge tour planned. 2024 for the Black Keys was going to be this big year where they were releasing their an album. It was called Ohio Players. And they had launched the album at South by Southwest. There was a documentary about the Black Keys. It was all, this is our time. Because when the Black Keys began kind of in 2002, they became as these basement kind of dwellers, and then they slowly moved up to venues like, say, Tripod in Dublin, where the people couldn't, like, there was just not enough room for the people who loved them, and then they became Three Arena superstars after the release of El Camino and Lonely Boy, which was a huge single of the time. And they've slipped back, and they were maybe anticipating that they were still stadium stars. And while there hasn't been an official line on why their tour was cancelled, it could be down to a few things. It could have been greedy ticket sellers hiking up the prices. It could have been tour managers shooting above their station, and maybe fans just not being as into the Black Keys as they once were, or maybe overall just an indication that the music industry is not what it was. I would have thought that would have filled the Black Keys, who are Dan Auerbach and Patrick Carney, with a rage that would have made some really, really interesting music. But this is mostly just a bunch of boring, noodling, bluesy love songs that they certainly gave us No Rain and they've given us No Flowers. And on the title track, I thought that they were kind of about to hint at some kind of evil grievances that they were going to settle. But again, just a love song. There's nothing much going on.
When I was listening to this morning, I wrote down one line, and I know it's unfair, but I wrote down bland soup of inoffensive nonsense. Is that too far?
No, not too far. I had more salt.
Cian, it's a collaborative album. There are other musicians or the songwriters involved here. Who have we got?
Yeah, so you've got Rick Nowels, who is a big worker, collaborator with Lana Del Rey. You have Scott Storch, who is a hip-hop and R&B vet, has worked with a load of the great pop girlies from the early 2000s. And then you have Daniel Tashian, who worked on Kacey Musgraves' Golden Hour, an album that I absolutely love. So, like, you know, sometimes you hear these big name producers and you wonder whether, you know, maybe they're needed to rescue something that's going awry. Look, I think this sounds really nice. I think you could easily put this on in the back garden when you were reading, and it's a nice sort of soundscape. But I think on further inspection, there isn't a whole lot to take away from it. I also find it a weird departure in sound. Like, a lot of these songs kind of feel like post-Britpop kind of Travis Stereophonics, which isn't like shade. You know, that's nice music as well, but it's just not what you expected. I thought there'd be a lot more blues, a lot more swagger, which is what you get from the Black Keys at their best.
Yeah, I'm going to play something from it so people can get a sense of it. This is Man on a Mission. That's Man on a Mission from the new Black Keys album, No Rain, No Flowers. Louise, you thought that could have been a great song. Why isn't it?
It could have been a great song. I thought it sounded a little bit like Beck, the E-Pro time, early 2000s. A little bit weird. But what fails to kind of baffle, or what fails to amaze me about the Black Keys, is they're not very political. And a lot of their songs, they're not very personal either. There's a real vagueness to their songs. And what a time to not be political. Like, it's very hard to do that. And yet they succeeded in doing that.
He's a man on a mission, but we're not quite sure what the mission is.
It's just to get through the day, I think, is what he's doing. But even there's a song called Make You Mine, which was co-written by Desmond Child, who is a powerhouse behind Jon Bon Jovi's greatest Hairspray 80s songs, like You Give Love a Bad Name, Live on a Prayer, Bad Medicine. He also did Aerosmith's Dude Looks Like a Lady. And the song that now is very different from those, but I was like, why couldn't the Black Keys do a big 80s, just, you know, leather pants, big hair song, because that's the type of thing that maybe they should be confident in exploring, and yet they just don't explore anything new.
Yeah, I heard that song, and there is no way I would have imagined that the songwriter who wrote those songs for Bon Jovi and Aerosmith had written that one as well. It doesn't feel like that at all. Have they lost any magic they might have had, Cian?
I think it's interesting. Is it they've lost their magic? Is their confidence just knocked from a bad year? Or maybe they're having a crisis of identity. Like, if we're not going to be a stadium artist, what are we going to be? It certainly sounds like the synergy isn't working right now.
And stars from both of you?
2.5.
2.5 for me as well.
Yeah. This time.
Samesies.
Okay, we will take a break and we will be back with the new album from MGK, Machine Gun Kelly, or whatever it is he's calling himself this week. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena, where finally it is time to release the hounds. Cian Sullivan, you say that MGK, Machine Gun Kelly, has been a musician who's managed to stumble into success repeatedly.
Yeah, so look, first time Machine Gun Kelly kind of came across in any sort of breakthrough way was as a rapper, and he mainly rose to prominence in 2018 with a high-profile rap battle against Eminem. Now, sometimes these rap battles are set up by record labels to promote things, because, and I think this may be the case here, maybe not, who knows, but that's kind of how he got his name on the map. So then, you know, the rap wasn't really working for him. He then pivoted into pop punk and has been releasing music in that vein. To be honest, he's more of a celebrity than he is a musician. He has a daughter with On and Off Again, but currently off Megan Fox. He's best friends with comedian Pete Davidson. And he's done a number of like body modifications. He's got his whole arms in a big, just black. He's like got his tongue painted black. He also has got his canine teeth sharpened into fangs.
Explain to me the game you play with your friends, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. We play this game called the Deal Breaker game, where the premise is when you're on a third date with somebody and then they reveal this important part of your personality, you have to determine whether you're going to get a fourth date or whether it's a deal breaker. Okay. And one contentious one for us was, what if they wear vampire fangs all the time? So when I saw this, I was like,
"You can't take them off."
Yeah,
surely you'd notice before day three.
They always covered their mouths and they laughed. This came to life for Machine Gun Kelly.
Okay, he's moved from rap, hip hop, post punk, all of that. How would you classify the latest album, Lost Americana, Louise?
I think I'd call it a mess. Really, it's because on paper, I can appreciate what he is maybe trying to do, because it's a little bit of rap, a little bit of rock, a whole load of pop. And I can understand this idea of Americana that he's going for. It's like this trailer park kind of trash is what it's shining it up to make it a diamond. And that's what, on paper, I'd be like, oh, that sounds interesting. But then when you get into it, when I was listening to it, I've just never understood an artist less. I almost feel like he's making fun of his audience, especially with the song Cliche, which the video and the whole thing has been marketed very well, because it's making fun of that NSYNC kind of plastic pop kind of rollout that we had all through the 2000s. And then the song is it's just one of the most bland pop songs I've maybe heard in the last 10 songs. And in the trailer for this album, which you said was narrated by Bob Dylan, MGK goes on to name check Bob Dylan, going, "Tell me, would you wait for me? Baby, I'm a Rolling Stone." And it just everything just falls flat, and I just don't understand why.
We're going to take a little bit of Indigo from the album, and I think it's important that if you're doing something else at the moment, you stop doing it and have a listen to the lyrics. I stopped counting my age because my face still looked the same. I both could listen to that all night, and I would rather not listen to any more of it at exactly the same time, and I don't understand it. Is it going to do well?
He has a strong fan base. Critics hate him. Yeah, that's the truth.
I think there's a lot to be said for the things that good-looking men get away with. Yeah. And I think Machine Gun Kelly is one of those. He's got the face of Nick Carter. He's got the tattoos of Travis Barker. He's got the talent of, I don't know what, a doormat. But in fairness to him, the pop-punk side of things that he does do, I think he does well, because it's very hard to do pop-punk explicitly bad. And there's a couple of songs called Starman and Vampire Diaries where he doesn't try to be as lyrical as he was on his J.R.R. Tolkien, he loves smoking line. And I think he sits well in that territory of not pushing the boat too far.
I hate that there's a song in it called God Damn, and I listened to the album this morning. 2 hours later, it came back in my head and I was going... And it's stuck in my head all day and it's still there right now. Look, we are going to get stars from both of you. First of all, Louise.
2 stars.
Keen.
Wish him well.
This made me weary. I don't even think he's trying. And if he's not trying, why should we? This is 1 star.
Kian Sullivan and Louise Bruton, thank you very much for checking out those albums for us this week. Tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Research was by Michelle Brown. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. And our sound supervision tonight was Jamie Doyle. I'm Rick O'Shea and I'll be back again Monday night at 6:30 here on Radio 1. John Creedon is next.